This is an interview with Ms. Rashada Alexander with the Youngstown State University Project on the Black Student Experience. The interview is being conducted using WebEx, and today's date is August 21st, 2023, and my name is Talicia Williams. Hello, Ms. Alexander.
Hi, Talicia. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm doing all right.
Let's start off with, where did you grow up? Where are you from?
I was born in Birmingham, Alabama, and raised in Florence, Alabama, which is about 2 hours away from Birmingham. It's in the northwest corner of the state of Alabama, up near Huntsville, which is really known for being a part of the aerospace industry and having a fairly strong connection to NASA. So there's like a space and rocket center there. So that was the area where I was raised, somewhere close to that.
Why did you come to Youngstown?
I had a cousin who is about 2 years older than me, who began there maybe about a year or two before I graduated from high school. And so I was familiar with Youngstown State from there. And I knew I wanted to go to an out-of-state school. I just wanted to get away from, I wanted to grow up, as it were. And I knew that that would be more likely to happen if I was not at a school in Alabama. And also, I just didn't want to stay in Alabama for college. And so Youngstown, I had applied for a scholarship there and actually got it, which was a huge part of it because it was a full-ride scholarship. And my mom was more comfortable with that because I was going to be closer to family. I had an aunt and uncle about an hour away and a cousin there on the same campus, which were of importance to her. And I was going to get away from Alabama. So that was important to me. And I got to go and they had all the, you know, all the types of classes and things and cool things I wanted to do. And so that was where I went.
Are you a first generation college student in your family?
Nope. I'm the first one to get a PhD, but I'm not the first person to go to college in my family. My mom went. Two of her siblings graduated with degrees as well as her. So I was not the first, but I was the first to end up going to a graduate school and then getting a PhD.
What was your experience like coming here to Youngstown and coming to school here? That experience being so far away from home?
Overall, it was good, but I think it's probably surprising that it was. So YSU, I'm not sure if it is still now, but at the time, it was often considered more of a commuter school, that a lot of folks who were getting degrees there were folks who had full-time jobs or had other types of career linkages or networks in the area. And so they weren't necessarily coming to have a full traditional college student experience. So those of us who came from other places who were seeking to have one, it was kind of like we were in the minority, as it were, to the other students. But what it meant was that you probably got a little bit more, you maybe had some more close-knit connections to the other people that were on campus. And you also kind of figured out how to make your own fun, which I think is part of what college is about. I think one of the things that's really neat about YSU is that I met a lot of reasonable people in the course of seeking my degrees, people who had backgrounds different from me, who had experiences different from me, some of whom were non-traditional students, all of those sorts of facets of humanity I got to interact with. And I got to do that while I was finding my own way in terms of being able to get my own degree and to get my own learning. It was a place where you saw people who didn't look like you, which was nice. As a Black person, I didn't know what it was going to be like to be in a place that, like, I didn't understand at the time things like predominantly white institution versus historically Black college or university. I really didn't understand a lot about those distinctions, but I learned at YSU in some useful ways. And I was fortunate enough that, and I think this will get to one of your questions, there was Black woman who's a professor in the chemistry department, Dr. Sherry Lovelace Cameron, who has since, I think she has retired officially. I hope she's living the life of leisure. But she graciously kind of took me on and was a mentor to me, which was extremely beneficial because I don't know that I have since been, and I'm thinking about this, I don't know that I've been in other universities where there was a tenure track Black woman professor in the scientific department that I was in. So she was there. So I got to see somebody who looked like me and had taken an interest in me and was mentoring me throughout my time there at YSU. And that was pretty cool. That was actually one of the things that was that enabled us to be able to start the Help a Sister Out scholarship.
What kind of things did you learn from your mentor as you grew and developed as a not only as a student but as a person? Were there like any things that helped you grow as a person as you learned from your mentor?
Dr. Lovelace, she was clear in explaining like what my project was going to be, what I was going to work with her on, but she was also flexible. She understood that I was a student working, and so she gave me the benefit of the doubt a number of times to help me, you know, make sure that I was actually able to, first of all, she looked for a way for me to have something that was the equivalent of work study, which meant that I could do the work in the laboratory but also get paid for it, which was something I needed as a student. And she also, like, I got to go to the regional meeting for ACS, and I knew so little. When I look back at how little I understood of the world in those days, I'm kind of amazed and appreciative of the folks that took an interest in and were patient with me. So I'd never presented at a scientific conference before. I didn't understand what that meant. I didn't understand what it meant to go places on trips for school or things like that. I just hadn't really done much of it. And so she, like when we went to ACS, we went to Cleveland, and I went to go, like I had family there, and they were able to come in to see my poster, and I was able to give them my talk and explain to them what it was, the research I had done. But I also had the experience of going to a conference and having an advisor there with me so I could ask them questions and I could try to understand what, you know, what was it that I could gain from this when I was talking to other people at other posters. What, like, I remember somebody asked me a question and I couldn't answer it. And so I went back to them and I was like, well, they asked me this question, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, okay, so, and so she walked me through it and she said, but they weren't asking you because they don't know, Rashada. They were asking you to see if you know, right? So this is a space where you are growing because you are getting asked these questions and you're having to answer them. And those were just, they seem very simple things, but understanding the environment that scientific and technological, like STEM research, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, the enterprise, like how research happens and how you go to conferences and you present and you explain to people what you're doing and then you publish papers and you, like all of those different parts of it, I didn't understand what they were. And she was a wonderful guide to help me understand those things. And I could ask her questions and not feel like stupid because I didn't know things. And that was a big deal for me.
What was your first year like on campus? What was that experience? Was it a culture shock for you coming here? And like you said, seeing so many different things that you probably would have never expected to see probably back at home.
It was a culture shock in a way, but not in a bad way. For me, it was just like, oh my gosh, I'm somewhere else and I'm having to learn and to figure things out by myself. And I was fortunate in that I had a full ride that first year. So it wasn't like I had to worry about where I was going to stay or, you know, like my meals were included. Like I was very fortunate. So I didn't have to worry about those things. I had, like I said, my aunt and uncle nearby. And because of the program that I had come in through, which was the University Scholars, I actually knew other folks too. And so I had a bit of a friend cohort as well. And those are people that I still keep in touch with. that I still talk with, and that, you know, my mom would jokingly call us, she's like, you and your little fruitcake friends, and she would say it jokingly, but, you know, she was glad to know that I had these other little friends. I had these other friends who were similar to me in that we were all folks who had excelled at school, but might have been a little dorky in our own way, might have been a little goofy, a little geeky, but college was sort of made for us in that was a place where we could find other people that were kind of silly and geeky and dorky, who were also neat people, and we could, and it wasn't considered a bad thing to be smart. It wasn't considered a bad thing to be a little bit wacky or do different things or whatever. So it was culture shock, but in some good ways for me. I also I had to make friends in a different environment. I had to struggle with coursework, and I did. I had to figure out how to develop the best habits for myself as an adult. I think when it comes to, because I know that this is really thinking about the African American, or my understanding is that this research is thinking about the African American experience. I think I was pretty fortunate because at YSU, there was a lot that I did not understand about the world as a Black person interacting in a higher education environment that was predominantly white, which is a lot of stuff I wasn't aware of. And I think it was a reasonable way to be eased into it because it isn't ideal, but the reality is non-traditional student spaces are often going to be more considerate of and welcoming to folks who are not, they aren't your traditional like 18-year-old white college student. They're going to be more welcoming because they have to be, right? If you know that folks are going to be coming in because they are a radiology tech or something like that, and they've got to come back in and get particular certifications or take particular courses, you're going to accommodate that much more readily than if this was a, you know, traditional brick and mortar sort of college where everybody who's coming here is just fresh out of, you know, everybody here is meant to be a traditional college student between the age of like 18 to 23 or whatever. So what that meant was that I saw folks in my classes and folks that I interacted with who were Black, who were Latina, who were from other countries, who had accents, who had different life experiences. And that was great because then I just assumed that that was who goes to school. Everybody. Everybody goes to college, right? Everybody is seeking to grow and to evolve. And so the culture shock that I then experienced, I think, helped me to be that much more cognizant of the world around me as a Black woman and as a Black scientist when I left YSU. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You were a chemistry major. I haven't met a lot of STEM majors while doing this project. Did you growing up in a town that was, like you said, heavily associated with NASA and heavily associated with like kind of like STEM careers with that? Do you feel like that influenced you choosing to pursue a chemistry degree when you came here? Why did you choose chemistry?
So the place where I live is about, the place where I'm from in Alabama, or the place where I grew up, excuse me, is about an hour, hour and a half northwest of that town that I mentioned that has the heavier aerospace industry and such. But I didn't necessarily have that as I grew up. A STEM career, it wasn't something that was mentioned as like sort of a, well, yeah, of course you could do that. I was never told I couldn't do it, but I just never thought about it. The thing that made me want to go into chemistry was that I had a chemistry teacher in high school, Mrs. Knipe. She, K-A-N-I-P-E. I will remember her probably the rest of my life. She, in my 10th grade chemistry class, she took a chunk of sodium. So if sodium, I'm not sure how much you know about elements and reactivity of them, but sodium, okay. So table salt is the way that I knew of sodium, right? Most of us do, right? Sodium chloride, that's the substance. But sodium by itself in its natural state is reactive with water, meaning it'll blow up. So what Mrs. Knight did is she cut a chunk of sodium. She kept it in a jar that was like under oil so it didn't react with water or air. And so she cut a chunk off of it and she put it in a great big beaker of water at the front of the class. And so then it blew up and I was in. I was like, whatever that is, I want to do that. Whatever it is that enables this, whatever the field of study is, that's what I want. And so that was where I started to get very interested in chemistry and the possibilities that it held. And so I came to YSU and I mean, I was pretty wide-eyed and bushy-tailed. I didn't know. There's so many things I didn't know. But I went into chemistry and it turned out to be a really good thing, I think, to go to YSU for chemistry because it was, and I'm not sure if it still is or not, but it was a relatively, not flat, that's not the word I'm thinking about. There was equipment there that I could lay my hands on and use as an undergraduate that in other institutions I would never have been able to use. So for instance, we had at YSU, I can't remember the size of it, but it was a large nuclear magnetic resonance machine. So nuclear magnetic resonance is the same thing as MRIs, magnetic resonance imaging, the same thing when you need to see something's going on in your body, a little wacky. So those machines are big and expensive. And there was one that I could actually sign up to use and to use for undergraduate research at YSU. And literally when I went to where I did graduate school, which was the University of Kentucky, a similar machine there, you had to undergo all sorts of additional trainings and sign up for it and have somebody watch you when you used it. Like, you couldn't just get on that machine. But at YSU, because of the nature of how the department was structured and the size of it, as an undergraduate, you could do some really kind of fun, cool stuff. You could get used to the chemistry department. You could get used to equipment. You could do things if you were doing research there that I just wouldn't have gotten to touch. So it ended up being one of those, again, sort of serendipitous things. I didn't plan it, but it turned out to work. It turned out to be really valuable for me.
Earlier you mentioned with your mentor, Ms. Lovelace, your connections with her and you building a relationship with her is how you ultimately ended up starting the Help a Sister Out scholarship. What was that process like? Like, how did you get that scholarship started and why?
One of my best friends is Kim Ford, who got her undergraduate degree from YSU as well. We graduated about the same time. And she ended up going on to an osteopathic school of medicine. So she is a DO now. So all the same things that an MD can do. She is an official doctor, the kind of doctor people think I am. When they see PhD, they call me Dr. Alexander. They're like, are you that kind of doctor? No, I'm not. She is. So we were both YSU and we ended up becoming very good friends and roommates. And we would joke because she's also, she is biracial, white and black. And so we would joke about, you know, when people would say something about money or having money or needing money or whatever, we would be like, well, you can always donate to the Help a Sister Out Foundation right over here if you want to help somebody out. We're college students. We need some help. And so we would joke about that because it was hard. You know, like, it was hard to do school. You know, it's the same thing, but probably worse for folks now. But then it was, you know, you might work during the summer. And you would save up money from whatever job you worked on the summer so that you would have money for books and to get started for the next year, for the next school year, the fall. And then you would bust your butt to get all those things, but your student loan, like if you were getting Pell Grants or you were getting any sort of financial aid, sometimes it would be later. And then you wouldn't necessarily have things lined up. And then goodness knows in the winter, then it would be like a hard, you know, January would come back. It could be a hard road to hoe. Because you had to change classes, like you were going to have different classes, so you needed different books, you needed different stuff. Now it's cold, you got to come back up. You didn't have a summer break where you could make money. You could try to make money over the Christmas holiday, over the winter holiday, but there was no guarantee of that. So it was a struggle. So we, but we got through, and then, you know, we had joked about the Help a Sister Out thing, but then when Kim and I were both grown, and we had jobs that paid better and such, one day she's like, well, because we still talk just about every week now. She would be like, she's like, well, are we going to do that? Are we going to start a scholarship? And I was like, I thought we were joking. I didn't think we were going to start an actual scholarship. But then the more I thought about it, the more I was like, we could do that. And I mean, it wasn't big. We were just like, you know, we could set aside each of us like $250 and allow that to be a $500 scholarship for somebody every year. $500 will get you at least a couple books, maybe a book, but maybe a little bit of something else you need too. And then from there it grew. And a lot of it was because Kim just was consistent about it. She was like, I would forget because I just wouldn't remember it. And she would be, and she actually talked to the folks at the YSU Foundation about how can we consistently do this so that we can get the tax benefits as well. But she continued to push. And then at some point she had a kid, she was kind of had a different set of time, had a different kind of bandwidth. And so then I was like, well, then I can do some more because she did so much at the beginning. So then we pushed forward and then we got to a place where we were both like, oh, we could actually endow this. Now, the reason that we had been able to continue it back to the original question you had was when we first talked about it, I reached back out to Dr. Lovelace Cameron and said, hey, do you know of folks that might maybe benefit from this? Because we'd like to do something for folks. And so she was like, sure. And she was willing to do it. Now, we never paid her. We never gave her any money. We never said, here's an incentive or anything. We would reach out to her or the YSU Foundation would reach out to her and she would go through the process of looking through the students because she would often know who, because we wanted to focus it on women of color who were seeking degrees in chemistry, biology. I can't remember if we specified other fields, but that was the space that we were interested in supporting, folks who had been like us. And so she would reach out and find folks. She kept track of how many folks had gotten the scholarship. Like she did a lot of work to ensure that we could do that. And we both of us continue to be really appreciative of it. But then we got to a place where we were like, okay, I think we can endow it. We can come up with the money to endow it. And if we do that, because it is a minority focused scholarship, that would mean it would be matched by funds from the YSU Foundation, so our dollars could go further. And that way we also, you know, because we would have friends sometimes that would want to give to it, and there wasn't a real clear way to do that. And we wanted to, you know, be able to keep building on it, but for us not to have to go, for nobody who didn't do it for a living to have to go figure out how to administer a scholarship. That was a lot of it, was like, let somebody else who's better at doing that do it every year so that we know it's going to be in perpetuity, but we're not the ones having to run around and do it. And so that was how it came about.
How did that feel, knowing that you created and like facilitated something that would end up helping so many young Black females like yourself?
Really fortunate, you know? I never thought that I would be able to endow to do something like that. Like, the idea that I could do, that I could set up a scholarship, right? It never occurred to me, but Kim was the one who was like, hey, we can do this. And she never, I think one of the things that's really cool about her, and I hope you're going to reach out to her and talk with her too, as a person of color, for her experience as well. But the thing that I've always found to be really lovely about her as a person in my life is that she doesn't get stuck on what you can't do. She gets very focused on what you can do. And so she saw that we could do something. So we did do something. And then we got to a place where we could do something bigger and more sustainable. And so we did. But I never thought I would be able to do that. And my baby brother, who was, when I started at Youngstown, Jacob would have been maybe 11. No. When I started at Youngstown, I was 18. So he would have been 8. We were 10 years apart. He died in January, which really sucks. But the idea that I could do something like that and be a sister that he could be proud of, that was kind of cool. And my mom, and you know, I have a brother who's still here, thank goodness. You know, they say that they're proud of me and that I've done a good job and stuff, but being able to do something like that, to know that, you know, even if it's just somebody will have to eat noodles one less week, you know, when they're in school, or they'll get one more book, or they'll have a little bit of an easier time somewhere, feels really good. Cause I mean, what's the point in accomplishing stuff if you're not going to help other people? I mean, I guess you could, but I never really wanted to. I wanted to help people.
Do you oftentimes hear from recipients, people who got the scholarship? Do you have any relationships with some people who may have had it?
I got a letter this first time, and I'm pretty sure it's probably something that, and I appreciate that the foundation does this, but, that they probably have the recipients just do, period. But it was really nice to get a letter from one of the recipients, because I mean, dude, like it's every little bit helps. If I had been a college student and somebody walked along and said, here's $200, I would have fallen down on my knees to thank them for that, because that was something, that was one less worry I would have. So to hear from somebody and to know that they got the benefit of something that I did, is, that's pretty awesome. I sent it to my mom and some other family members and stuff, and I was look what we were able to do, like, isn't that neat? And they were all excited too. I mean, it's not every day you get to do something good for somebody else. I mean, yeah, you can do good stuff for somebody else, but it was nice, to say the least. It's good.
That's so awesome. Like, a lot of people, once they move on and become successful, like you said, they oftentimes are so caught up in their own success, they don't think about going back to help. And so that, I find that really interesting.
Thank you.
You are, I got it right here. You were named the director of the AAS Science and Technology Policy Fellowships. Mm-hmm. First of all, what is the AAS Science and Technology Policy Fellowship?
So, the fellowship program is a flagship program of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. That's where the AAAS part comes from, the AAAS. So that the program, what it does is, we are seeking to make sure that folks who are making policy at the federal level, so folks in the Washington DC and the seat of the federal government who are crafting federal policy and implementing it, that they have expertise from the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics perspective. STEM is the acronym that we often use, because when you think about it, when you're thinking about climate change, when you're thinking about pandemics like COVID, you know, infectious diseases, when you're considering how we deal with issues that we have around our resources, when you think about technology, what are we doing in the space of artificial intelligence? How are we using it? Cybersecurity, all those different things, they have huge roots in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. But often the folks who are in federal spaces, they don't have that expertise. So this program seeks to make sure that that expertise is in place, or at least to be one resource for it, by putting folks who have, usually folks who have doctoral degrees, into one of the three federal branches, either legislative, executive, or judicial, for 1 year, potentially two, to see how policy is made, to understand how does that actually happen. Because a lot of us who are trained as scientists, we don't know how policy actually gets made. Just as the folks in policy spaces don't always know what the STEM expertise is that's relevant to the policy decision they're making. So we look to make sure that the policy is as evidence-based as possible, and to give our capabilities to that, contribute to that. And also to teach those folks who are scientists and engineers, this is what the policy landscape looks like, this is how it works, so that they walk away with a lot of really useful knowledge about how they can be a positive part of that. And also those federal spaces, either the executive branch agencies or the legislative branch, the Congress, our senators and our House representatives, that they have access to that STEM expertise too. So that's what this fellowship does. So I actually came to DC through this fellowship. The fellowship, I was a fellow in 2009 through 2011. I was at the National Institutes of Health. So I got to work there. So if you've ever heard of NIH or the National Institutes of Health, that's where a lot of cutting edge cancer research, a lot of research around infectious diseases. During the pandemic, if you heard about Anthony Fauci, he is one of the leaders at NIH in the infectious disease space. So I got to go there as a fellow, and I got to do all this really cool, amazing work through this fellowship. So it's transformative for me. I really don't know what my career or my life would have been like for that. I moved to DC. I've since, you know, made most of my close friends I've made through this program. I met my husband after moving to DC. Like, it's a huge part of how I have evolved. So when the opportunity came up to potentially lead it, I thought, well, there's no way, like, if I get selected for that, there's no way I cannot do that. And so that's what it is. So it's a real full circle kind of space for me, because I get to lead this thing that blessed me in so many ways. So that's pretty cool. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. How did you get started within that program? You said that the fellowship was the only reason you went to DC. How did that process go about?
So I knew that I wanted to continue to benefit science, right? I started off as, I mean, my first official training as a scientist really happened at YSU. That was where I first did undergraduate research. That's where I first did scientific bench research. And then from there, I got to go into a number of undergraduate research experience programs, which further whet my appetite for research. And then I went to graduate school. Much thanks, as far as I'm concerned, to Dr. Lovelace, because she actually helped me understand what grad school, well, I had no idea what any of those things were. And so I went to her and I was like, well, what do I do next? I don't understand what I do. And she's like, here's what grad school looks like. Here's how you do that, so on and so forth. So I went to graduate school. And while I was there, I started to realize that I didn't necessarily want to stay working at a bench the whole time. And when I say working at a bench, I mean doing the actual scientific experiments to get the results and to be able to publish and all those things. That is typically the track that people tell you you're supposed to go on when you're a scientist. That's what you're supposed to do, which is similar to what Dr. Lovelace did, for instance, right? She went, she got her training, then she got her PhD, she went somewhere, she got a tenure track position, she worked, built a research program, retired from there. That's what lots of people expect folks to do. I realized I didn't necessarily want to do that. I wanted to figure out how to benefit the world in science in some more strategic ways. So I started looking around to see what else could I do with a PhD in chemistry? What else could I do with this scientific training? And so the fellowship was one of those spaces that I found I could actually take that expertise and I could parlay it into a career in policy. I could actually go and help people who are figuring out what is the best policy, how do you implement the policy smartly? I could be a part of those conversations. And so that was how I ended up coming to this fellowship. And it, as I said, it was transformative.
Why do you feel like your heart was steered in a different way to do something else rather than the traditional way?
You know, I think some of it actually was probably rooted at YSU. So when I came in, I don't know if the University Scholars Program is still there, but it was started right before I came to YSU. And I wasn't able to maintain the high GPA that was required, but I was able to still get scholarships and figure out how to get through school with a combination of student aid and student loans. But one of the things that you had to do as a university scholar was to engage in community service. So you had to find ways to do stuff for other people, which I think was one of the first places where I realized that you could, right? You could go to a nursing home and you could bring gifts to people and you could come and sing Christmas carols and you could interact with those people. You could talk with those people. You could go somewhere and clean up a place. You could go do something past just your books, right? Just past just your study. So it was one of the first places where I started to see how when you were performing higher at an academic level, the expectation was also that you maybe perform higher at a community level too. So it started that awareness in my head. And so then with that started, going on to graduate school or postdoctoral training, I think I had already started to think about the world past just my schooling, just my learning, just my stuff. And so then it made sense to, when I went to graduate school, and also when I was at YSU, I was also involved in, it was a biology honor society that I had been an officer in. Dr. Lovelace had actually initiated us setting up a chapter of Kappa Alpha Mu, which I think is like, it is a Black honor society. It's an honor society at the college level, specifically for Black students. We started a chapter of that. So doing things outside of just my schoolwork was sort of seated there. And so then I continued to do that. And when you do that, you start to think about, well, what does my schoolwork mean to people who don't talk the same language I do? Meaning, like I'm sitting here talking to you and you've asked me about a few things in the scientific space or the technological space. And I'm trying to also make sure that you understand what I'm talking about, because it isn't really useful if you ask me what something is and then I just throw a bunch of words at you and you're like, well, that doesn't mean anything, but what does it actually mean? So then I started thinking about that, right? What does this matter to other people? So I was fortunate in that when I went to graduate school, there were opportunities for me to do demonstrations for elementary school kids and to show them like, here's what happens if you freeze a banana and here's what happens if you do this kind of experiment. Here's what you can do here. And so that, I think it just continued on. And so it didn't make any sense by the time I got to graduate school and postdoctoral training. It didn't make any sense not to think about what else did my work mean? What else could I do? Who else could I help? Who else might this matter to? Didn't make any sense not to. So it just kind of was the way of it. And then it makes even less sense when, you know, as a scientist, you try to explain what you're doing to your family. They don't understand a lot of times unless they're also scientists. So then how could I make sure that they saw the value of what I was doing and make sure that it actually had some value? So all of those things were always sort of working in my head, because my family would ask me like, okay, so what are you doing now? Well, what does that mean? Well, are you help? What are you doing? Are you helping people? Are you getting people jobs? Like, what are you doing? And so it was a nice sort of barometer for myself to always think about like, what else could I do? What else could I do?
What kind of networks did you build while working in the community? What kind of relationships did you build outside of school? You mentioned a lot about how that helped you evolve as a person and how you thought about how you could express and teach people in different ways. What networks did you build outside of school within the community?
So theater was a big one for me. I was active in the theater department and took classes and was in plays and stuff and just enjoyed myself. That was a pretty big piece of it for me. Also, the friends that I had made through the university scholarship was, those were folks that I engaged with quite a bit and did things that they did outside of that as well. You know, if there were other events or other activities they had, sometimes I still hung out with the folks who were still in the University Scholars Program. If they were doing community service like Earth Day or something like that, I'd still go hang out with them and volunteer in those spaces. And then I feel like there's something else I'm missing. Through the Black Honor Society, that was a space where I got to know some other students of color on campus, which was important and helpful to me just in terms of understanding. Because YSU, it's interesting, like YSU has, I think Youngstown tends to get, at least for a long time, the organized crime facet of it was a lot of what people knew about Youngstown and that area. Mm-hmm. But there are also other facets of the area too. Like you go further out and you start to understand, you know, there's this thing in Niles and this thing in Warren and this stuff in Boardman. You start to understand like this area and all that it has. So I would just interact with, I would interact with other students and stuff that I would meet through classes because they were often, like I said, non-traditional. So they weren't just there for, like, they weren't just staying on campus and campus was their whole life. They had other lives outside of YSU. So I would just kind of hitch a ride, as it were, and get to meet other people and see other things.
You mentioned earlier that you were part of the Biology Honor Society.
Yes, and I cannot remember the name. Cannot remember the name.
And within that group, you started Alpha Kappa Mu.
I think it was Kappa. It was, I can't remember if it was Alpha Kappa Mu or Kappa Alpha Mu.
Okay. How did you like get started creating that group? And what did that group mean to you as you grew in your career?
It wasn't a particularly strong factor further in my career. The way that it happened, I think Dr. Lovelace and a few of the other Black professors and Black faculty on staff saw the opportunity and the benefit of having such a thing. And so they worked and they helped us understand what needed to happen and how you would get that set up. But our part was relatively, you know, we as students, we weren't the ones who were necessarily setting it up. There were other folks who were more involved. But the thing that was valuable about it for me was, first, I didn't know that there were honor societies that would be just for Black folks. And so that was like, oh, okay, so this can be a way to further connect with and support other folks of color on an academic campus. Like, that's a thing you can do, because I had no idea. The other thing is that it helped me understand how beneficial it could be when you're on a predominantly white campus to have some things that are intentionally for folks who aren't white, you know. And that carried over for me into thinking about, like, what does it mean to be the minority in a space, right? So when I went to the University of Kentucky, it was very valuable for me to realize the power in connecting with other students and graduate students and other professional students of color. And so when I started off at the University of Kentucky, that was fortunately how I got to first meet people on the campus, was I got pulled into some of the minority focused activities. And it was wonderful because those people at UK became really my community. At YSU, because you didn't feel like there were so few of people who looked like you, I think I probably took it for granted that I would go places with people who look like me. And so when I went to a really predominantly white institution that was much bigger and much less real, is the only way I can put it, having had the experience at YSU meant that now I understood, okay, there will be activities that I can push and I can initiate and I can have that will help me grow and be supported here in this environment that might be kind of harsh if I don't do that. So it was useful for me there. So it wasn't like a direct thing there, because I think YSU also, I was an undergraduate, I was trying to figure lots of things out, and frankly I was really naive about quite a few things, so it wasn't directly beneficial there. But because I left YSU with such a, I don't know, I have warm feelings for YSU because of how I was able to grow there. And so it made other places look, frankly, quite, you know, anemic by comparison. So I'll just be very candid with you. I was happy to endow a scholarship to YSU. There are other institutions I have gone to and have been educated at that I would never give them any more of my money. I would never give them any more of my money. I would be like, nope, nope, you got your own stuff to figure out, get it together. But YSU, yeah, I will. Because I think there's some space there that's unique for the folks that it serves.
In the AAS fellow program, what are some more things that you are enforcing as a director? What are some things that you're doing and changing in your lead role at the fellowship program?
So the fellowship, this is our 50th year of the fellowship. So the first class was in 1973 with 7 people all placed in Congress. The program now, our last class that started last fall, that 50th cohort, is 300 people strong across all 3 branches of the federal government with about 30 folks on the Hill. So like a significant bump up in how many folks get placed on the Hill and then in other executive branch agencies too. So I am thinking very hard and working very hard towards what are we going to celebrate at the 60th anniversary? What are we going to celebrate in the next 50 years? So that's the way that I've been thinking about this program. So there are two sort of big thrusts for it for me. One of them is after 50 years, there's a lot of really cool ways that we can ensure that federal policy, that policy in general, gets some STEM expertise integrated into it. That's a big part of it. And so I am looking at the ways that this program can expand. So in what the program is currently doing, so for instance, we are actually launching an artificial intelligence focused cohort. So again, you've probably heard about ChatGPT, about all these different places and ways in which AI is going to change our lives and is already changing our lives. So given that, let's make sure that the folks who are in Congress, as they're thinking about policy, as they're thinking about regulation, that they have the expertise that can really help them to figure out what is needed to advocate for what makes the most sense, to enforce what is actually enforceable, to hold companies accountable, but also to help us as consumers be smarter in what we're doing. So that cohort is being launched now. So that means that Congress will have some specific expertise in this area in a way that is quite unique. So that is one example for me for this fellowship where I want it to be able to respond to what's happening in real time. Things don't often wait for a fellowship cycle, or they don't often wait for a very neat, tidy bow, right, to be able to do them. So I want to figure out ways for this fellowship to really harness the power of the folks who have come through it. We have over 4,000 alumni, and every year we add about 300 people more to that. So I want to make sure that those folks are well situated to keep helping folks, helping our federal workforce, including our elected representatives, craft and implement policy that is based on scientific evidence. I want to keep making sure that happens, but to figure out some new and interesting ways to do it. So that's one space of it. I want to expand what the program's already doing in some specific and targeted ways. And then I want to take what we've already learned and figure out how can we implement that into the training space. There's a lot of learning that comes from a program like this. How do we make sure that it really gets plugged back into graduate and postdoctoral training? That's something I'm very interested in. It's helpful for me. I'm just asking, is all this helpful for you? I'm just making sure I'm being of use. Okay.
Yeah, I'm trying to follow as much as possible because even though like I don't know much about tech or STEM, I have grown a small interest in it lately. And so I'm able to follow a little bit. And I wanted to ask you about, did you have something?
No, I was just going to tell you, as you're going through and working stuff up, if there's anything that I've said that doesn't make sense, you can always follow back up with me, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Well, I was going to double back a little bit and ask you a little bit about the AI. There's been a bit of a crisis in the technology world as far as AI goes, where people feel as though like AI is going to come and take over everything. and impact people negatively. It seems like it's hard for people like you who work closely with artificial intelligence to get people to understand the positives of artificial intelligence, because they just think it's coming in to replace it. It's like, how do you deal with that space? How do you teach people artificial intelligence in a positive light?
There are a couple things that come to mind, but they're long-winded metaphors, and I don't know if they'll be useful for you, so I'm going to do my best to be useful and not just talk a lot. So one thing that I find, and this is me, Rashad Alexander, as a person talking, not necessarily as director of the fellowship, but something that I think often happens for us is that we see technological innovations coming down the line, and we often struggle with accepting that they are going to change our environment, not just be a tool. Mm-hmm. So I remember years ago somebody explaining to me that eventually we were going to be able to do lots of things wirelessly through the internet. We were going to be able to do all sorts of stuff. You're going to be able to pay your bills and make flights and all kinds of stuff. And I was just like, and this was like in the early 90s. And I was like, hey, we're going to do that? And I was like, well, what if people don't have the capability to do it? And the person talking to me was just like, Rashada, you don't understand. You don't understand how it's going to change, right? Think about how right they were. I was thinking, like, how are people going to have access to this? But now, on the same device I'm talking to you on, I can do all of that stuff. And in fact, if you talk to somebody who can't do all of that stuff on their phone, you wonder what the frick's wrong with them, because it changed the environment. It wasn't just a tool. It changed the whole landscape. I think AI is one of those things that has that potential and is already doing it in certain ways. So, using the internet as an example, is it all bad? No. Is it all good? No. Is there a lot in between? Yes. Is it more useful for you to know how to use it and to understand what it is than to not? Yes, it is. So understanding what's coming down the line is usually going to serve you better than kind of putting your head in the sand about it or pretending it can't possibly affect you. AI is already doing things that are wildly beneficial. So it's helping people in Maui figure out how to respond to the forest fires that are raging, right? The wildfires that are raging, mm-hmm. to understand where people are, because we have tons of geographical data that folks can look at and try to figure out, okay, this is an area that's going to have this happen or this happen. You think about it, in Canada recently, there was a town, and I know it was scary for folks. Was it Canada? It could have been Hawaii too, but there was a town in one of these places that's getting ravaged by wildfires that had about 20,000 people there. And they were able to estimate they were going to need to evacuate that place very swiftly. That's foresight that we don't always have, and we haven't had before in previous parts of our history. So there are benefits, right? But there's also some real negatives. But if you have folks in policymaking spaces that at least understand the limitations of it, and also some of the issues that can come up, then you can have a more real conversation about what can happen, as opposed to a very fear-based conversation where all you're trying to do is prevent something, when in fact you don't even know if you have to be worried about preventing that thing. You don't even know if that is the actual worry that's coming at you, right? So having some understanding of that, and not just folks like this AI cohort that's going to come in, this group of fellows who have this expertise, I also want to make sure that the rest of our 200 plus fellows have access to some training so that they get better at understanding what the platforms are, what the considerations are, what it means to use ChatGPT versus, I'm trying to think of another AI chatbot, but like different AI chatbots, understanding what different ones can do, what you need to be careful of when you're using them, what environments in which do you not need to use them, because maybe they're not the best tool yet. They might be the better tool in 2 years, but they're not there yet. Helping folks to get that way, for me, it kind of calms the temperature. It cools the temperature down so that everybody is not feeling like we're actively about to be boarded and invaded by robots or something. I know, but that is a fear that a lot of people have. But if you can mm-hmm. understand the realities, that can help you to adapt a lot better. And plus, you can actually use some of those tools in the spaces where they can help you and recognize where they won't.
That's very interesting, because like I've been seeing a lot of stuff lately where it's like people only highlight the negatives, and that influences people like me what's like in the future, and possibly in the next 10 years or so, we'll be using AI for almost everything, like how we use our phones for almost everything, like you said. And so I feel like to be educated about those things, and the fact that you are educating people about those things is really cool, because I would love to learn more about it, since I've had interest in attempting to work with that kind of stuff.
I encourage you to dig around. There is some really useful, you will often find that there are a number of nonprofits in this space, nonprofit organizations that often their goal is to educate folks like you and me, who are just, we aren't necessarily doing AI things every day. We may not know all of the lingo and all the terminology, but they are seeking to help us understand. And so that we can be smart, so that we can be protective of our data, of our ourselves and our families and our homes and all those sorts of things, but so that we can do it with a mindset of at least being empowered, as opposed to just being embattled, like we're constantly being attacked. That'll wear you out real quick.
What would you say to young Black females in the same industry as you? Because industries like science, technology, engineering, and math are not dominated by Black people in general, let alone Black women. So what advice would you have for Black women who are likely they're going through the motions and they're learning a whole lot of new things, and it's just something that's new for them, it's something that sometimes is overwhelming for them. How do you suggest that they deal with it?
It may be hard, but most of us do hard things all the time. So don't let the idea that it's going to be hard be the thing that chases you away from it. Chances are, if you sit and you think about your day or your career or your particular professional interest or whatever, you've done something hard already, and you're probably about to do something else hard, or you're in the middle of doing something hard. So yes, there will be hard things. That doesn't make them undoable. Find folks who look like you where you can and talk to them. If you can't find folks who look like you, start visualizing what it will be like to be the person in that space. Start thinking about that. Just because there aren't people who look like you doing it yet doesn't mean that you can't do it. That is not what it means at all.
Yeah.
And if it, especially if it's something that moves you, that you're really interested in and you're moved by and you want to give to, let that be a thing that moves you. Let that be a passion that moves you. Chances are you will find, I mean, that's one of the benefits, again, of the internet right now, of being able to access things in so many spaces online, is chances are you find somebody who looks like you, right? When I watched Hidden Figures, I tend to denigrate my mathematics capabilities. I tend to say I have a minor in math from YSU, and I'm quick to be like, I don't like doing math in front of people. And then I mm-hmm. watched the movie Hidden Figures, and I was like, Rashada, these Black women were doing math in a time when nobody would let them use the same bathroom as their white counterparts. I think you can do the math at a restaurant. I think you can do math. Stop it. Stop saying that. Stop doing that. There are mm-hmm. tons of spaces where folks who look like us have been busting their butts and excelling in a lot of different places already. Sometimes you need to be inspired by what has come before you. So think about that. What did I say? Find people who look like you. Don't be afraid of hard things. You know, there is, more often than not, you can do the thing that's hard. You can do something new, right? More often than not. I had a mentor say to me once, you know, there are things that you can't do. Can you climb Mount Everest? Probably not. No, right? You probably can't climb Mount Everest. But there's probably a lot of stuff you could do. So before you tell yourself you can't do something, think about if it's really a thing you can't do, or if it's going to be a thing that's new or hard. That's different. And you get to be worried about that. You get to be scared about that. You get to give yourself space to process those feelings. But if it's a thing you can do, treat it like a thing you can do. Try it. The time's going to pass anyway. You might as well try it.
Your whole entire story is very inspiring, because I don't see a lot of Black women who are doing what you're doing, but your story can encourage them to do that. Because no matter what field, because I'm in the psychology field and I work in the archives in Mogg Library, and I'm doing this project, and this is a project nobody's ever done before. So it's nice to see a Black woman pioneer like yourself who can continue to encourage young Black girls like me. It's like we're doing something we've never done before, and there's so much stuff that we're like diving into, like doing interviews and stuff. This is the kind of stuff I've never done before, but that don't mean I can do it.
And one of the best things you can remind yourself of is that everything worth doing is probably going to involve something you've never done before, right? I bet when you started this project, you were like, I don't even know what I'm supposed to look for, where this is supposed to go, whatever. But now you've created a research protocol. You are going through the interviews. You've developed your questions. You're figuring it out. A friend of mine and I used to joke, no, we still joke, about an acronym called FFIO, F-F-I-O. And the first F usually stood for a swear word, but you could substitute frickin'. And we would just say frickin' figure it out. Frickin' figure it out. There's so many things that other people don't know how to do them either, right? It's not that you are the only one who doesn't know how to do this. A lot of things will pop up that you don't know how to do, but chances are you can figure it out. And give yourself that, like, recognize that you can figure it out. You can do that.
Yeah, I'm learning that slowly.
Yeah, give yourself time.
Try not to discourage myself.
Good. Encourage yourself.
Earlier you mentioned Miss Kim Ford. Do you have any of her like ways to contact her? Okay. So I got that down, and I'll make sure to contact her as well, so we can get her for an interview as well. Because the Help Us Out scholarship is like, it's really interesting to me.
Yeah. And I think I know you're talking to students, but have you already talked to Dr. Sherry Lovelace Cameron?
No, I have not.
She should be, I don't know if she'll be considered emeritus or what at this point in time, but if you get a chance to talk with her, I think she'd be an excellent person to talk with too. Just because she's seen a lot of students come through the chemistry department and stuff. And so there could be folks that, you know, you'd want to reach out to that she could link you to.
Okay. Thank you so much for everything you contributed, just everything, your whole persona, everything. Thank you. Thank you for being who you are for us.
I appreciate that. That means a lot to me. And thank you for the work that you're doing to highlight the stories of those Black students at YSU that, you know, you're going to find a lot of really cool stuff, and nobody would have known it if you hadn't come through and started this project. So thank you for doing it.
Thank you.
All right.
You have a good day.
You too. Take care of yourself. Let me know if you have any other questions.